Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney.
Oh, yes! Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan on a beautiful Saturday. Andrew Gundling and JJ Devaney. What's up, brother?
Hey, man, how are you?
It's the eve. It's the calm before the storm. Don't you just picture every single person in France right now just like standing in front of a mirror with a French jersey on, just screaming the lyrics to One Day More from Les Miserables?
I do not envision. So that's just they're me. Much cooler than that. They're probably shrugging their shoulders, smoking a cigarette.
They're screaming One Day More into a mirror.
Yeah, I think they're not as dramatic as you think they are.
What a show. I mean, for us to be here on a Saturday, this is, and for a non-emergency pod, this is just like a regular day's work.
Oh, there's nothing regular about it.
I know. It's the eve of a World Cup final. Don't get to do these very often. Next time we do it, it'll be in the winter. How fun is that?
Yeah, we've got a lot of people contacting us like this was news when actually Sam Borden
reported
was in a different job in 2015 when he called it.
Yeah, I guess people are only frustrated by it because that World Cup was not originally sold to be that way. Remember, they were going to air condition their stadiums.
Of course,
like that was a thing.
Well, they'll still probably have to anyway. It's going to be really hot out there.
When that World Cup was first announced and that was suggested, there were some people like, "Oh, that's years in the future. By then, who knows what'll be going on in the world? Air conditioned stadiums is nothing." Well, it's not really that far in the future.
It really isn't.
Flying cars that are going to be taking
it's an appalling vista on our horizon.
But we will talk about that more on another day. We are here for one reason and one reason only, and that is to analyze the third place game between Belgium and England.
That's it. Let's get into it.
I joke.
We're runner up. We're not even runner up.
No,
we're third or fourth.
No, we're obviously here to talk about France versus Croatia. We're going to talk with James Montague coming up in a few moments. He's on the ground in Zagreb, actually, to kind of provide the Croatian side of things. Obviously, we'll break down this game from all angles. We've got a big World Cup trivia that I know you're very excited about, and an even bigger mailbag that I know I'm very excited about.
Great mailbag, and we've also some iTunes reviews.
Oh, nice. But I thought that we'd start this kind of just like, here we are. It's the World Cup final. Like, this is like such a thing to be excited about and celebrated, and this tournament has been so much fun. I think the build-up to this game has been worthy of the fact that this is just a once-every-four-year event. So with that in mind, we've kind of taken, as we like to do on this show, for anybody that's listened now for more than a few episodes, you know that we are nostalgic, that we like to take a look back. So we've come up with our favorite moments from a World Cup final and our most memorable moments from a World Cup final.
Right.
Would you like to go first with yours?
Yeah, sure. And this isn't because he was assistant. Down the line, he became assistant to Giovanni Trapattoni as Ireland manager. But it's more about the celebration almost than the goal. This is Marco Tardelli in the 1982 final. And for years, this was always the promo to any final. The look of absolute joy on his face after nailing one against the West Germans in Spain.
It's Giroud. It's Fagioni. It's Giroud. They're appealing for offside, not given. Giroud right across to Marco Tardelli.
John Motson on the call.
Which keeps Italian fans warm at night in these dark days, these cold nights of non-World Cup involvement, I'm sure.
Yeah. My favorite moment, look, World Cup finals typically, at least in recent memory, don't provide you with a ton.
No, you're struggling.
Yeah. So I actually went with this one from 2010.
Torres. No, it drops for Fabregas, who looks for Iniesta, who's onside! Spain score! They take advantage of the extra man, and they believe they're going to win the World Cup for the very first time.
I chose that one for a couple of reasons. For one, I find him just eminently lovable as a player.
Yes.
So for Iniesta to have scored it,
and
I
that
just
team
was
too.
Well, that's the other thing is I think, you know, underdog stories are great. Not that the Netherlands are a huge underdog, but the way Spain were viewed, I mean, they were viewed in an unbelievable regard. And that's kind of why I wanted that to happen. I think we love the underdog story, but we also want to recognize when we are witnessing greatness. And I feel like that Spain team will go down as one of the great national teams of all time. And for them to validate that praise by defeating the Netherlands, I thought it was just very fitting. I felt that was the right team that won that tournament.
Kind of surprised that you didn't go for Nigel de Jong's kung fu kick to the chest of Xabi Alonso.
The first of many in a long line of Nigel de Jong kung fu kicks. And then most memorable, I'm going to go quickly here, this is not one that French fans listening will remember fondly, but when you talk about memorable, for me, it begins and ends with this.
In terms of the decision, as long as they've seen it, it is impossible to argue against it.
This is the incident. Matarazzi had an arm round Zidane there. Then they looked at each other. Why did this go on so long?
Well, I think words were obviously said, weren't they? Obviously, Matarazzi said something.
There it is. Oh, you can't excuse that. Zidane's career ends in disgrace.
It was just a moment that when you saw the replay, you screamed. I mean, it was just
It was
like,
shocking.
I couldn't believe it. And then what do you have?
Again, like I said, I was challenged to find a piece of audio that I haven't used before that I found hugely memorable. This is the Sky Italia call from the same game of Grosso's winning penalty for Italy. And that's Giuseppe Bergami, who actually played in the 82 final. And to hear him be so joyous, and then to contrast that with his usual resting face, which is, I'm going to kill you, is amazing.
Yeah. Look, I mean, we can be sappy about this and all that, but I saw Ivan Rakitic made a comment that I thought was just great in the lead up to this game. And he said, I would definitely leave my football boots behind on Monday if that was the price, talking about winning the World Cup for Croatia. If I had to pay that to win for my country, I would rather win for Croatia. Look, if that happened, his agent, maybe his family, they would shake him until he relented.
But I understand the sentiment.
But I think he believes it. Like, I really think that he feels that way, and that's the cool thing about this tournament. Say what you want about FIFA's corruption, about the commercialism that surrounds this game. These guys, these players who, you know, multi-millionaires many times over, none of that matters in this tournament. Like, France didn't buy Kylian Mbappe. Like, this is who he is.
Right. So, and they've all made their journeys from their various locales in their various countries to this moment. I think it's more than that. I'll be honest with you. Nationalism is a dirty word. Right now in the world, febrile xenophobic nationalism it's a wash. It's everywhere. It's terrible. This is a nationalism we can all get behind. It's pride in where you've come from, in a good, positive way, in a sporting sense. It's, in fact, I would go as far as to say the only nationalism we should celebrate.
And it's, I don't know, I find, like, that comment from Rakitic, I just find to be eminently genuine. And maybe some people will think that that's naive, and maybe it is, you know, because these guys are millionaires. But I don't think that any of that plays any role in what's going on in this tournament. I think that it's just been, you know, just, like, pure love of the game, love of your country that these guys just get behind and they rally behind it. And we've seen the way countries throughout have rallied behind it. And it's why we love it. There's no question about that. Let's get into the game itself now. I'll tell you what, let's start on the Croatian side of things with our buddy who has been on this podcast before. You see his writing all over the place, the New York Times. He's written a book. One of our favorite guys to talk to. He's in Zagreb, Croatia right now. It's James Montague back on the program. James, what's up? How are you?
I'm all right. I'm sitting on the side of a highway on the outskirts of Zagreb, in front of a bar I've been drinking in to watch the England-Belgium game.
This feels like the start of some very bizarre, like, coming-of-age comedy about it, like some soccer fan who's just lost.
Man, you have really hit the nail on the head. I didn't order any White Russians or anything, man. Sorry.
Well, I'll tell you what, James, set the scene for us from Zagreb. I mean, is there an inch of that city that you could be standing in right now and not know that Croatia's in a World Cup final?
Yes. Outside the spa is a little bit outside the town. There's not so many people outside here, but I've been in the centre all day, and it's absolutely packed full of people. And what's interesting is full of people from around the world. I mean, Croatia is a very small country in terms of population, 4 million people, but it has a huge diaspora, mainly from the war. A lot of people left, you know, from the early 1990s. Everyone knows about the Yugoslav war, so they kind of spread around the world. So there's lots of different types of accents. I mean, I heard just so many Australian accents because there's a huge Australian Croatian population. A lot of people found a home in Australia after the war, and they've all come back. Well, seemingly all have come back, but there's a lot of people talking about cricket, football, talking in Australian accent. So it's really interesting being back, because although it's definitely a Croatian experience, that doesn't necessarily mean it's an experience simply for the country. It's for all the Croatians around the world who seem to be kind of homing back into Zagreb to celebrate what is, one of the great sports stories of all time, to have a country this small reach in the World Cup final.
Can I ask you a question specifically on football and Croatia? Because I was listening to Adrian Childs, who himself is part Croat. His mother is Croatian, and he was speaking on the BBC about how there aren't really any great footballing structures in Croatia, and in the sense that there isn't some overall football plan for the country. He said you can travel around Croatia and you won't see pristine pitches or 4G all-weather surfaces. So how do you explain the rather excellent footballers they keep producing?
Well, I mean, he's absolutely right. There is no plan. And there's been a couple of great articles, New York Times and ESPN in particular have picked up on a couple of these, which is, there isn't a kind of an Iceland-style plan whereby you kind of build these pitches, kids come and play on them, and then you produce, so there's a pipeline that you produce. That just doesn't happen here. This is a pretty, I mean, I wouldn't say it's poor in a kind of a developing world type of sense, but it's a place that still has its problems, and it certainly isn't. There isn't an academy that's kicking out all these players. When you look at the Balkans and certainly kind of former Yugoslav countries, of which there are six republics within that have all kind of broken away, and there's various different countries that have come out of that. They are now very small countries. Whether you look at Serbia in terms of population, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, Bosnia. These are countries that had before the breakup and the wars in the 1980s and 90s, a Yugoslav sporting culture that has kind of carried on. Mm. And so although there isn't a big infrastructural kind of pipeline, there is a culture of playing sport and being involved in sport that does go back a few generations and does seem to link all of these countries, whether it's not just in football, in handball, in the Olympics, if you look at basketball, there's still a huge amount of talent, and that's largely because people play, and there's a culture of people playing sports, whether both men and women in a variety of sports. So, yes, there is no infrastructure, but there is still a culture of people playing here.
James Montague joining us here on Caught Offside from Zagreb in Croatia, a day before the World Cup final. James, you mentioned Iceland. And in looking at Croatia, they finished behind Iceland in qualifying. Their manager, Zlatko Dalic, is a relatively recent appointment. They sent home Mario Mandzukic's replacement after their first game. I mean, Croatian fans, they're a passionate bunch. They love this team. But from people you've spoken with there, did they really believe that this was something that this team was capable of?
Well, I mean, I think you have to qualify that a bit, in which now they do love the team, but not everybody loves this team. I mean, this is a team that was very difficult to love, because before, I mean, if you're talking about the past kind of 2 years, or two, well, actually 4 years, Croatian football has kind of been embroiled in a corruption scandal. There was Zdravko Mamic, was this kingmaker within Croatian football, who's been convicted of corruption offences, and his corruption within football, whilst he was kind of controlling Dinamo Zagreb, which was the biggest football club here, has touched a lot of the main players who passed through that club and, had contact with that guy. So look at Luka Modric. Luka Modric is probably, I don't think it's uncontroversial to say he's probably the best player at this World Cup, or certainly one of the best players at this World Cup. And he has been one of the main figures in dragging Croatia to this final. And he had to go and testify at Mamic's trial. He was found out, essentially, he's been charged with perjury for lying at that trial, or allegedly lying at that trial, I should say. And he faces 5 years in prison. And all this was happening in the beginning of the World Cup. And so a lot of Croatians were very unhappy with this national team, very unhappy with Modric. And they thought that the most important thing was to kind of lance the boil of corruption within Croatian football rather than support this national team. So the national team which, if you remember, back in 1998, got to the semi-finals of the World Cup in France 98, narrowly lost to France, who they play in the final on Sunday. If you think about, back then, only 3 years after the end of the Yugoslav, one of the Yugoslav wars that ended then, the Croatian national team was a real symbol of the nation. And then 20 years later, everybody had kind of abandoned it because of all the corruption camps. So this wasn't a popular team before this World Cup. It has become popular largely because of the performances of the team, because they have they have really kind of performed above what people expected of them. When they kind of destroyed Argentina in the group stage, it's come out of a very tough group stage. They beat England. And really, that victory against England has now solidified the nation in a way that was unthinkable a month ago. A month ago, if you'd said, a month ago, people were wearing Croatian national team jerseys in Russia that had phrases on the back which Modric had said during the trial, which he was widely mocked for, this Mamic trial. And now he's being held up as a national hero. So wow. People are kind of like forgetting, putting to one side some of the corruption elements of that and the allegations. And a wider kind of rally round the flag effect is happening. So it's a really interesting thing being here and experiencing that compared to what I'd heard kind of a month ago, which was, this is probably the most unpopular team in Croatian history.
Winning really is a beautiful antidote, isn't it?
Really, it's a great way to launder a reputation, isn't it? Really, I mean, when you're winning, you can do really anything.
Speaking of something that's along a similar track, so the Croatian Prime Minister visited the dressing room after the Denmark game, hugged Zlatko Dalic and a few of the players, and this seemed to cause a furore in Croatia. Now, look, this is a naive question considering the region we're talking about, but I really want your insight on this one. So Croatian fans seem desperate to ensure that their football team, and particularly this success now, is not in any way associated with politics. And it just makes me wonder, in modern European Union-dwelling Croatia, is sport still used as a political tool?
Well, I mean, it was the president who went into the locker room and then famously danced a little bit in front of Medvedev, which didn't seem to go down so well. So let's see how Russian and Croatian relations are afterwards. but what was fascinating about this was that you've got to remember, this is a country that only recently joined the European Union. And, we're talking about a war that's within living memory. And the first democratically elected Croatian president afterwards, after that war, was Franco Tudjman. Mm. And he did this in 1998. He was at the World Cup. He would take the football team to dinner before they beat Germany 3-0, which was a huge shock in France 98. He went to the locker room afterwards and met all the players. And he was a guy who, although he was an authoritarian, he was a guy who was he has a troubled legacy in many ways. He saw the power of sport in helping to build a national identity. And that's a very powerful thing still within Croatia, even whether you're on the left or whether you're on the right, that's still a very powerful thing. And the president today doing that was very much trying to tap into that. And actually, I mean, for a lot of Croatians I spoke to, politicians have been trying to kind of follow Tudjman in finding reflected glory in the football team or in a sports team, whether it's handball or in water polo or any other sport that Croatia is pretty decent in. But she actually did it with a little bit of panache. I mean, she's clearly a football fan. And so, yes, there are people who want to keep politics out of football, but it really, in Croatia, it's not quite a situation where people are trying to exploit it, although people do try to exploit it. Mm. It's more that sport is it's a very good signpost for how to understand the modern Croatian state. If you think about 98 and then to 2018, 20 years later, I think both of those sporting triumphs and failures tell a pretty accurate story of where Croatia is in the modern world.
James, one more for me. Croatian players, it seemed, after the England victory, kind of went all in on the disrespect narrative. Do you agree with that? Have they been disrespected? Are they maybe a better side than a lot of people believed prior to that England game?
Listen, I mean, as you can tell from my accent, I'm English. Well, I'm half Polish, half English, but yeah, I speak with an English accent. For me, I gave an interview on BBC World Service beforehand, the morning of that game, and I said, look, Croatia are favourites for this game. You know, they have a playmaker. They have two playmakers. They have this pivot with Rakitic and Modric, you know, key players for Barcelona and Real Madrid, something that England doesn't have. England is a very, or was, I should say, now they've been eliminated from the tournament, was a very well-organised, if quite limited, team. Croatia were the favourites for that game. And somehow, over that next 24 hours, because of this It's Coming Home chant, which, by the way, I mean, I know this is a very... I'm trying to explain that chant. Maybe it looks arrogant to outsiders, but for most people, that was an extremely ironic chant. Mm. We've lost. We've lost every single... We are terrible sports people. We lose almost everything. And so it was a kind of inside joke. It's coming home. Of course it's not coming home, but we're going to sing It's Coming Home. And suddenly, Modric comes out and gives this interview. I don't believe for a second that this was a motivating factor. I think what is kind of the most important factor for Modric and for a lot of the players in that team is to try to find an external enemy, really, because Modric and certainly other players like Dejan Lovren, anybody involved in the Mamic affair who have been kind of roasted over the coals of the domestic international media, are looking for someone to create an external enemy. And they found it with the English press, who, to be honest, I mean, as we all know, I mean, they're a very easy target if you want to make an external enemy. But the idea that they were motivated in some way, Modric has to deal with the Madrid press. Now the English press is somehow kind of worse? I mean, it's an utterly ridiculous thing. I think it was a very clever way of trying to shift... you know, a lot of the pressure away from those players towards somewhere else, and I think they did it very successfully. I mean, you could ask why there was a well of sort of opinion that was very easily led towards a situation where people thought that the English were particularly arrogant. I mean, we don't help ourselves in many ways, but, you know, the idea that they were motivated by something Gary Neville said on TV because they might be tired after playing back-to-back extra time. It's utterly ridiculous.
Final one for me, James. Is it fair to say that they're worried in Belgrade and Podgorica and Tirana and all the capital cities in that region that it is coming home? How is this being viewed by the rest of the Balkans?
Well, it's a really interesting thing because, I mean, I live in Belgrade with my partner and my child. And looking back at a lot of the tabloid newspapers, which are extremely nationalistic back in Serbia, you know, there's a question on the front page of Blitz, which is one of the big ones, which was, do we support Croatia? You know, and Novak Djokovic was quoted as saying, you know, yeah, I'll be supporting Croatia. So it isn't as black and white as many people would say. Like, oh yeah, we're not gonna support Croatia because of the wars. Actually, there's a lot of kinship here. There's a lot of people who grew up in a time as well where, you know, this was one country. I mean, a lot of the players playing on Sunday were born at a time when Yugoslavia still existed. And so although each has their own stories about war and being refugees or escaping kind of a horrific experience, you know, sort of almost 30 years on, you know, it's become much more of a nuanced kind of conversation. Mm. And so, yeah, I mean, if you've got... you know, nationalistic tabloids asking questions like, who should we support, England or Croatia? I mean, in a way, that's progress. I mean, England is part of the United Kingdom. We were part of the NATO bombardment of Belgrade in 1999. You know, I mean, they're all small victories, but this is pretty much, you know, I think it's a very important step forward in normalising relationships between a lot of countries in the region. Saying that, I did see a lot of Slovenian fans supporting Russia when I was in Pula, which is in the northwest of Croatia. I heard a lot of Slovenian fans supporting Russia over Croatia. So it's not gone. But the fact that someone like Djokovic feels comfortable enough to even raise that question, as do tabloids within Belgrade and Serbia, you know, I think that's I think that's progress in a way. Very small progress, but progress nonetheless.
Well, it happened at Euro 2016. I mean, there was a lot of people in the Republic of Ireland were kind of cheering on Northern Ireland when Ireland weren't playing. So I guess that's progress.
Yeah, James, I'll tell you what. I just got off the phone with a bartender, and there's a beer waiting for you on the counter. So we're going to let you go, and we're going to let you enjoy that. Thanks, man.
Are you sure it's not a White Russian?
I said Bud Light. I hope that's your drink of choice. I don't know. Good stuff, man. Enjoy the game tomorrow. Take care.
All right. See you later. Bye-bye.
Good stuff from James Montague on the ground in Zagreb. Interesting.
It's crazy interesting.
Yeah.
I did a little... Because I grew up during the middle of that war, and every morning it was something going on. But it was so hard to understand all the different factions. So I did a little bit of research the last few days. It's so complex. It's incredible. That's why I asked that question at the end. I mean, I don't think you can take it for granted.
I didn't see that Novak Djokovic said that. That's fascinating to me.
I didn't see that either.
I don't know.
Could you imagine down the line if Serbia had made it out of the group? Yeah. And if they could have, well, they could. There were different sides of the bracket, but still.
I'll tell you what. Let's talk a little bit more about the action on the field. So Croatia, let's talk about why they will win this game. I'm not saying they will, but if they do, why will they be able to do it?
It's very hard for me to say that they will do it, but it's going to be that tandem of Rakitic and Modric controlling the pace of the game. The French, I don't think, are going to change from what they've done in the previous games. They'll be, like against Belgium, they'll be happy to sit back. But I think if Croatia can create the overloads, remember early on in that game, Hazard versus Pavard, that looked like that was only going one way.
Yes.
And I think if they get a foothold in midfield and try and create overloads wide for their two strong running wide midfielders in Rebic and Perisic, that's a real chance that they can create opportunities. I just don't see that, because you know what's going to happen with that French midfield is Kante is going to be able to slide across and be able to combat against numbers up. And look, their two fullbacks, Strinic and Vrsaljko, are crucial in what they do. How many times were they in the ball in advanced positions against the English trying to create overloads?
Vrsaljko, it seemed like all the time.
Right, and he ultimately was the creator with a beautiful cross of the equaliser. Now, the English only really had Henderson in there trying to get across and help out, whereas the French will have Kante and Pogba. And Pogba's been very adept at that defensive side of his game.
I'm going to talk more about that when we get to the French part of this.
So for me, that's the main area of success. Look, as good as Rakitic is and Modric is, even if Brezovic is the holding midfielder, which allows those two to function in a more offensive sense, can you honestly see them getting centrally through this team, this French side? I don't. So it's going to be the wide areas. If they're going to win, it's going to be success with overloading numbers against those French fullbacks. On one side, Hernandez, and on the other side, Pavard.
Yeah, for me, I look at this right now, and it's kind of piggybacking off of some of what you said, but the thing I like about Croatia is that their best players are playing like their best players, at least at this moment. I thought it took Rakitic a little bit more time to get into the tournament, but he was incredible, I thought, in their last game against England. Modric is probably the player of the tournament right now. This is from Paul Carr, who wrote this in talking about Modric. He says he does defensive work, which is not necessarily a thing that you associate with Luka Modric, but in this tournament, Carr says he's done the defensive work as he's tied with N'Golo Kante for the most recoveries at this World Cup, and no player has won possession more times in the middle third of the field than Luka Modric has. In addition to that...
I don't mean to cut across you. Keeping the ball is defensive. England couldn't get the ball off him. Uh-huh. His ability to keep it for a long second. He did an Eden Hazard thing. How many times when the game was stretched did he get on the ball against England, win free kicks, or simply maintain possession? That's huge defensively.
And then I thought even Perisic was incredible against England as well. Obviously, we know he scored the goal. Right after that, he hit the post. I mean, he was really wreaking havoc throughout that game. His manager at Inter Milan, Luciano Spalletti, said this about Perisic. He says, Perisic is the only player who can be compared to Ronaldo from a physical point of view. Says the way he moves, how strong he is. That's pretty high praise, and I think he's validated a lot of it. Now, he was a high-profile target of Manchester United last transfer.
Forever,
and,
he seems to
and
be.
Now they're in on him again, and we'll see if Inter are able to hold off United's interest. But he's been sensational, I thought, especially in the knockout stages. And then the other thing for me with Croatia, this is more of the mental aspect of this, but I don't think there's a scenario where you could see them drop their heads. This is three straight matches in the knockout stage where they've trailed. Modric had a penalty saved against Schmeichel that looked like it would have won that game for them deep in extra time. They sent a potentially crucial player home after their first game against Nigeria, and they've only gotten stronger throughout the course of this tournament. So I don't think, if France go up 1-0, if France go up 2-0, I don't think you'll see anybody on that Croatian side start to feel like, resigned to defeat.
And whatever they're saying, there is the sense that, after the trials and tribulations of the knockout stages, guys, we're kind of playing with house money here. I do feel like they will feel that. And that brings a certain freedom. Problem with that is French on the break.
Yeah.
Let's
talk about the other side of this. We talk about why Croatia will win. What about why they will lose?
Well, they're going to have a goal. What does have a goal mean, JJ? I don't see the Croatians sitting deep. I don't think they're going to want to do that. And the French are going to do that anyways. And on the break, in broken play, the pace of Mbappe, you're going to have to look for two tired fullbacks, all right? In that, the gap between the two fullbacks, the fullbacks in the centre halves is going to be huge. Vida and Lovren have to have the game of their lives again. Now, what was interesting for me was England had a tactic where for the first 20 minutes, they were isolating Sterling against Vida and against Lovren. And it was kind of working. And you thought, as this game goes on, early stages, Vida's got the energy to get back and clean up. But I thought England should have persisted with that tactic. Maybe there's a counter-argument, they went to it too much. But what I'm saying is this, the pace in behind of an Mbappe is going to hurt them hugely. The movement of a Griezmann is going to be absolutely massive for me. Now, also, who do the French start at centre-forward? If they play Griezmann as that kind of pivot.
Will they not just continue to go with what they have?
Giroud, I meant.
Okay.
If they play with Giroud there, look, I honestly think Giroud is going to involve Lovren and Vida is going to have to try and be alert to those runs in behind between the fullbacks. That's a huge thing for me. More than anything, Mbappe is going to have those two fullbacks because of his movement. He's the only one, really, himself and Griezmann in that forward line have kind of free roles where they can make different runs and pull defenders out of position. Mm-hmm. That's not what England had. England actually were pretty static up front in that sense.
And Harry Kane, who is England's greatest threat up front, had moved almost into like a number 10 role.
Right, towards the end.
Yeah.
So that gave Lovren and Vida less to do. That's not going to be the case in this game.
Definitely not.
And that means your two fullbacks are in the back foot, and that takes away an overload the other side of the field. Attacking-wise, you look at numbers in the middle of the park, I see Croatia being overrun there, and that's a problem.
By the way, you mentioned Lovren. Old English Andy was very hurt by some of Dejan Lovren's comments after that game, when the wounds were still fresh. And James kind of hit on some of the chip-on-the-shoulder mentality. And look, I'm all for teams doing whatever they need to do to push themselves through and to create an enemy that can, kind of like a hot dog at the end of a string, something that you're chasing.
A siege mentality.
Yeah, but I don't know. Some of what Lovren said, putting the microscope on himself in the way that he did, maybe he didn't intend it that way, but demanding respect, saying that he is the best defender in the world and it's time that he be viewed that way. No, you're not. Not to me.
Well, first of all,
it just felt a little bit to me in watching that, like, I'm not saying he's bad, but it felt like if at the end of the Lakers having won the NBA Finals, Derek Fisher getting up on the podium and saying, I'm the best player on this team and it's time that I be recognized as such. No, you're on a team with Kobe and Shaq. Modric, Rakitic, Vrsaljko, these guys are having, Perisic, these guys are having outrageously good tournaments. Lovren's been fine, but for him to then get up there and demand that he be viewed as the best defender in the world, I mean, come on.
Here's another thing for me with that. Since Jimmy Traore, a Liverpool player as well, has a player ever had a worse mid-season and then by the end of the season be involved in a Champions League final? If I was to tell you when he was substituted on the half hour at Wembley against Harry Kane and Spurs, that this guy would be in a World Cup final after have been in May in a Champions League final. Yeah. Would you have believed it?
No.
No. And he got dogs abuse. And he lives in England, so he knows the view of English people of him. And you know what? Straight after the game, you know, to use that phrase that the kids are using, he's feeling himself.
Yeah.
He's feeling good.
I get
He's up in his feels, as the kids on the street are saying, because I'm down with the kids. That's what they're... That's how he feels.
Well, English Andy wasn't ready to hear it.
You know
that's
what? He's
saying.
Pumped full of adrenaline. He's just shut England down. He's in a World Cup final. He's feeling good about himself.
One other one for me. I feel bad saying this before we get to France, but for why Croatia will lose this game, I don't know, man. Daniel Subasic has maybe been the keeper of the tournament, but...
Courtois Pickford?
Okay. I said maybe. Relax. So I feel bad saying this because of that, but I wonder if his body is betraying him at the worst possible time. Because he was clearly hurt. He was clearly hurt at the end of the Russia game.
Couldn't dive for...
Well, and that's the thing. Look, when I watched Kieran Trippier's goal go in, there's nothing Subasic really could have done to save it.
There's a lot, though. He didn't even move.
But that's the this is what Gab Marcotti said about Trippier's goal. The free kick was accurate if slow, but Subasic moved even more slowly, and it nestled into the net like a dead leaf propelled by the wind.
His right groin hamstring means he can't propel off it to his left. I don't think he can save to his left.
If this goes to penalties, if you think that, what do you think France is thinking right now?
Just put it down the right hand side, down his left.
And I hate that this is even a thing. And we could so easily be proven wrong if he comes up big on a penalty or whatever. But
look at the save he made. Everyone's talking about the Harry Kane denial. He hit that onto the post. Slow motion proves that's going in, and he's put it onto the post, and it hits him and goes out again. And everyone's going, save of the tournament. The last desperation of an absolutely stricken man. That should have been in the back of the net. That's a great save, but that's an indication he's not healthy as well.
He's had a few days. Maybe it's had a chance to recover somewhat.
Possibly.
But it looked like a muscle injury, and those don't usually heal in a couple of days.
He couldn't take the goal kicks at one point in the Rush game.
So that would be a small concern for me.
But there's a concern as well with Strinic, who came off. And to be fair, he was replaced by Pavaric, who came in and was really, really good. So maybe Strinic doesn't start either.
Yeah.
Look, there's wounded men, and they're taking the field for Croatia. It's as simple as that.
Let's look at France now. Why will they win this game?
I think they're better in numbers, right? I think their defence... Look at the game Varane had the last day. Look at the game that Umtiti had. And the two fullbacks are in decent form. So that's your base there. And a goalkeeper who's really feeling himself right now and has grown into the tournament in Courtois. That's your base there.
In Lloris, but...
In Lloris. And right in front, you've got Pogba and Kante, who again are growing into the tournament. Maybe not, in Pogba's case in particular, playing that kind of offensive role that we love to see, but really shutting down teams. And then up front, you've got the wild cards in Griezmann and Mbappe. That just seems like too much for Croatia to handle.
Yeah. N'Golo Kante, for me, I think if France win this game, I think he's going to be the golden ball winner. Fourth in the tournament right now in interceptions per 90 minutes. He's had five interceptions in the attacking half, which is the second most in the tournament. I mean, that's probably the most crucial place that a player can thrive. This is from Paul Carr again. For a broader example of Conte's importance, check out France's 10-game qualifying campaign. In the 397 minutes that he played, France surrendered 0.4 expected goals per 90, compared to 0.9 in the 503 minutes where he didn't play. There's a lot of people are afraid of stats, but there are some instances where I love them, because 10 years ago, a guy like N'Golo Kante, you knew he was good and you could say that to your friends, but like you didn't have the numbers to back it up. There's now like a whole host of statistics out there that do prove that guys like N'Golo Kante are maybe the most valuable players
on
their
team. And you know what? The eye test in some of these cases doesn't always work. Like if you've been watching the game for a long time, the way he gets in and gets those interceptions, wins tackles and sets the team off, it is noticeable.
Absolutely.
But often, it does slide under the radar. There's no doubt about it.
Because a lot of those interceptions don't necessarily result in much for France. But what you forget is it blew up an opportunity for the other team. Also, the attack, I think it's obvious. Mbappe, Griezmann, Giroud with Ousmane Dembele as an option off the bench for when Croatia are getting some tired legs if this game's close late and he comes in.
I agree with you. The bench is so loaded. Like, there's a strength in depth there that is just frightening. Absolutely frightening.
I'm going to read a quote to you, and I want you to try to guess who said it. Pretty hard thing for you to guess, but nevertheless, this was written in the Telegraph as a guest columnist. He said, I like to watch games from a midfielder's perspective, and Mbappe's runs are almost identical to those Thierry used to make for me. His finishing, when he opens up his body, his movement going in behind, it's all so similar. When I watch him, I just think how much I would like to be playing behind somebody like Mbappe because I like the strikers to move.
I mean, that could be any number.
A couple hints in there, a midfielder.
Zidane?
No, it's Cesc Fabregas. He's a guest columnist in the Telegraph. Said that about Kylian Mbappe.
By the way, I was listening to Philippe Auclair, who was talking about his favorite French team. And of all the French teams of the last 20 years, from 98 on, he enjoyed the beaten team in 2006 the most.
Interesting.
I went back and I thought it was Euro 2000 was my favorite team. And it was. And I was watching Zidane. If Kylian Mbappe had Zidane... Now, I'm not saying Griezmann's not a good player.
On which team are you talking about?
On this team.
Oh, if Zidane was playing.
Oh, my Lord. And by the way, Henri was providing that role for him as well. But even at that point in Henri's career, I was watching the Denmark game from Euro 2000. Henri missed so many chances. Now, he scored. Oh, my word. This wouldn't even be a contest.
Now, I'll ask the question of why will France lose this game. I'm going to be honest. I had a really, really hard time answering this one.
It's a tough one.
Can I go? I mean, I have a real reach here.
Go on.
Now, Pogba's role, I guess, is kind of what I would bring it down to. But even that, I put a gigantic asterisk on because what he's being asked to do, I think he's done a great job doing it.
And he's still doing a good passing game.
Yes. That's why my answer is so fraudulent. It's just that I don't necessarily love, like, I kind of want to see the more creative Pogba, the more attack-minded Pogba. I give this guy so much praise. Hugo Lloris said earlier in the tournament that Paul Pogba is one of the best leaders in the world, that no one realizes that. The media, in the way that they talk about Pogba, in this, you know, he speaks four languages, Paul Pogba, and he's tremendous with that. He just seems like a very easy guy to fit in the locker room. I feel like there's this reputation around him that's just not true, that he's a me-first guy, that he's a look-at-me guy. And everything you read and everything you hear from his teammates don't back any of that up.
He does things that the proper football man never had to do back in the day, and so that irks the proper football man. And people like me, it irks. The social media side, the blue hair, all that. But
come on. We got to get past that.
I know. I'm admitting I'm wrong.
All right. By the way, I like to hear those words out of your mouth.
He speaks a ton of languages.
Four languages, yeah. It's amazing. And you know, Didier Deschamps said about Pogba, he was everywhere. He's been absolutely everywhere. And that's what he's being asked to do, but mainly in the middle third. And I think that's what frustrates some people, myself included, because, you know, with Juventus, you know, we've seen what Pogba is capable of in the final attacking third, but he's been redeployed. He's kind of sitting in next to N'Golo Kante. They're patrolling that. And Didier Deschamps has decided that for us to win, that's not what we need from Pogba. We have attack-minded guys who can take care of that. I want to deploy him in the middle third. And look, it's worked so far. I guess I'm just somebody who enjoys the creative sides of his game. We don't get to see it at United. We're not seeing it now. But the reason I give this guy so much credit is because you don't hear a peep out of him. There's no complaints. There's no problem in the French camp, which is a thing that a lot of French players grew up just being used to, hearing dissent against the manager. There's none of that from this guy. He just falls in line. He's one of the team, one of the guys. He deserves a lot of credit.
And also, Didier Deschamps has been here in Euro 2016. If this is a more conservative France, it's because it is. He's not going to get caught again. He's not going to get fooled again. He knows he can sit back and be solid, and he will get 3, 4, 5, 6 good chances with Mbappe, even with Giroud. I know he's not scoring, but he's still on the end of things, or rather clumsily in the last game. Griezmann, Matuidi, they still will have those chances. And when they score, it's going to be tough for Croatia. It really
is.
Very much
so.
Like I said earlier, if they can get at Pavard and Hernandez, they have a chance. But seeing them do that is really tough for me. Yes. The other way is a set piece, where Croatia scored at a time when it's 0-0, maybe on the hour, and then it's a backs-to-the-wall effort. Mm-hmm. A classic, dull final. Grim Greece 2004 effort.
Yeah, but part of me almost wants to see that happen, because I would love to just watch France.
Attacking France.
Attack!
Unleash the dogs of hell!
I kind of just want to see this team that has so many talented attack players.
You and the rest of the French nation.
Well, I don't think they want to see their team trailing on the hour.
They don't. But again, I talk about Philippe Auclair, who I was listening to, and said, you know, there's a bit of a shrug about this team. If they win the World Cup, everyone's going to be delighted.
But when is that shrug going to turn into just a smile?
Andrew, there's a flair that they expect from things, and I guess it comes from their...
I'm sorry, they're not like... France are great, and they should very much be in this position. I get when a Brazilian fan says that, because they got a lot of World Cups to back up that mentality. But France have won... They've won one World Cup and one European championship.
It's French expressionism. Look at the way they play in rugby. Like... If they have a dull rugby team that grinds out things and that's not free-flowing passing rugby, they don't want to know about it. It's about
they might win the World Cup. At what point do we just say, let's just win? Who cares what it looks like?
Will you just listen to your European when he's telling you something? Two Europeans.
Me and
Philippe.
I can't even see you on the pedestal. Have you gone? The clouds.
Look,
the clouds,
winning is the ultimate panacea for all ills.
Well,
you're right in that.
I'm going to get on my pedestal now and knock you down a peg. Yeah, it's my turn. You ready for some World Cup final trivia?
Not really, but go on.
All right. Well,
it's not trivia. It's always numbers with you, and
yes,
I'm not good with
just
numbers.
Just like this one. Did you know that France versus Croatia on Sunday will be the 900th match in World Cup history? Name the other 899. I'm kidding, of course. JJ, if Mbappe scores tomorrow, he'll become the second teenager ever to score in a World Cup final. Who's the other one?
Pele.
That's correct. Pele.
Age 15.
Let's see. You're the second one here. France have trailed for just 9 minutes and 12 seconds of this entire tournament, all against the same team. Name that team.
Oh, who were they trailing? Oh my God, I can't even remember who they were trailing to. I can't remember. I've drawn a blank.
Do you have an answer?
Was it Australia? I don't know. I can't even remember.
It was Argentina. It was Argentina.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. God, that's short-lived.
9 minutes and 12 seconds the entire tournament. Let's see. Third trivia question here. Can you name the last time a team scored more than one goal in a World Cup final?
The last time a team scored more than one goal in a World Cup final was probably 2002's Brazil.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's, as you always say, it's a tetchy turgid affair. Sounds like you're right.
I'm from Westminster now. I'm a member of parliament, isn't it?
That's correct.
How dare you?
That's correct. Normally we stop at three, but a World Cup final calls for far more, JJ. Oh. So I have three more. Ready?
Right.
No matter what the result tomorrow, someone is going to win a World Cup and a Champions League or European Cup in the same year. Either Rafael Varane for France or Luka Modric and Mateo Kovacic for Croatia.
Mm.
It's not all that common of an occurrence. Only 10 other guys have ever done it, a World Cup and a Champions League or European Cup in the same year. The most recent of which occurred in 2014 for Germany. Can you name that player?
2014 Champions League.
This is a tough one. This is a hard one. You definitely know the guy, but it's difficult.
And he won a World Cup?
And a Champions League in the same year. I'll even tell you the team that won the Champions League if you're drawing a blank.
Sure. No, I remember who it was. Toni Kroos?
No. He hadn't made the move yet. Sammy Khedira.
Oh, Khedira. Yeah. Okay.
The last time that France was in the final, they lost on penalties. Who missed a penalty for France en route to Italy, then going on to win? One French player missed his penalty. This is also very difficult. But I should know that.
Give me a hint.
Let's see. He scored a really big goal for them in the 2000 European Championship.
Oh my God, David Trezeguet.
That's right.
Trezeguet missed it.
Yeah.
I've forgotten that.
Yep. And then last but not least, each of the last three World Cup finals have gone to extra time. Who has scored the winning goals either in extra time or in penalties in each of those games? Now, I will say a couple of these have already made it onto this show today.
Well, Iniesta.
Right.
Of the last three,
uh-huh.
Iniesta in 2010, in 2014, Götze.
Yeah.
And what's the other one?
What are you doing?
What?
You already used it.
What did I use it for? What are you on about?
Fabio Grosso.
Oh, Grosso, yeah.
That was your moment, and you forgot. That's very funny to me. Why are you looking at me like with these daggers in your eyes?
Grosso's was a penalty kick.
Right, I said, who scored the winning goals either in extra time or in penalties?
All right, okay, cool. You know it goes down.
I love that this ended with you just in disgust.
Yeah,
with me.
But you know that goes down as a 1-1.
Yeah, but
the penalties are fine.
So Italy didn't win that World Cup. My bad, everyone.
They did, but
JJ corrected me. Italy did not win.
Grosso's
that game.
Was the winning penalty kick. It was uh-huh. not the winning goal.
Well, what did you think I meant when I said
Iniesta? That's why you confused me.
In the question. You don't listen to me. You drifted off to that Donnie Darko world again.
It's true. I'm sorry.
You don't listen.
Well, I got it right.
I'm telling you what. your attitude during these trivia questions, knowing how much you despise them, you better believe they're coming with us into the Premier League season. Oh, you better believe it.
I can't do an entire season
well,
of
I'm
that.
I'm sorry,
that's
but
really
it's happening.
Unfair.
Let's close it out now with a mailbag. This is where you speak.
Don't condescend to me.
All right, what do you have?
Stephen Bradican. He can't see France losing. The midfield three of Pogba, Matuidi and Kante, best player of the tournament, will at worst be just as good as the dominant force of Croatia's midfield three. You can't argue with that, really.
I mean, look,
it's a good analysis.
You're right. It's, I don't know. I feel bad for Croatia because their midfield is so good with those guys, but it's almost a wash. Like, if you're going through position by position, France are so loaded at the same spots.
Yeah,
so.
And also, and I'm not saying that the England game is any reflection on the skills of Modric. He is a brilliant player, whether he plays England or not, but England gave so much freedom to them.
Yes.
That just won't happen, you think. Eric Beck has got suggestions. Hi, Andy and JJ. Love it. Keep calling him Andy.
Nah.
Just started listening to your podcast about 6 months back. Now I don't miss an episode. A few episodes back, you were discussing finding an alternative to PKs. This is his idea.
Okay.
If a game ends in a draw, the tiebreaker would be who scores first. This will generally reward the team with a more attacking mindset, albeit with a few exceptions. The only snag would be a nil-nil draw. My suggestion for a goalless draw would be not to reward either team with any points. So a nil-nil draw would essentially be treated as a loss for both teams from a points perspective. So he's, I mean, basically revamping league football with these ideas here. In the knockout stage, you may still need PKs if you get a scoreless draw there, but this would still drastically reduce the number of overall draws and stop rewarding teams for not engaging. I don't know about this. By the way, if UEFA or FIFA want to use my idea, I'll happily let them use my intellectual property in exchange for cash and Spurs season tickets. Eric B., Maryland Heights. Thanks, Eric. Dave Bleha.
Is that how you say that last name?
B-L-E-G-J-A. Bleha. Okay. Bleja?
I don't know.
Blaja.
Just your face looked weird saying it. You made me like uncomfortable.
Well, I'm just ruining this guy's name, and he's taking the time to send an email all the way from Melbourne, Australia.
Wow.
Hi, JJ and Andrew. Love the pod. Thanks for loving it. I'm sure you'll hate it after me destroying your name. Genuinely perplexed with the contempt you guys have for the third place playoff match. I know you're hardly the only ones to express the sentiment, but I was wondering if you could explain your rationale, as I've never understood this phenomenon. By this stage in the tournament, the games suddenly and drastically thin out, and I can barely stand the soccer withdrawals. It seems flatly bizarre to me to get incensed at this very moment that FIFA managed to squeeze in one more match before it's all over. Anyway, I've personally always found it to be a thoroughly enjoyable match, certainly more so than the final, which is traditionally a dour and nervy affair. He goes on for much further, but okay. I can't keep going with this, Dave.
Totally fair point. And he's right in saying that the third place game is often more enjoyable than the final in terms of how it's played.
But for nothing.
Just to go from the like emotional peak of a semifinal and having lost that match to try and ask a team to get up for what essentially amounts to a meaningless game. Now, I do know that there's money at stake, but we just started this podcast talking about how this is not really a tournament where that's a factor in players' minds. And I don't know how many guys in that game are really going full bore because they know there's a small financial difference between winning it and losing it. I don't really see that as being a massive incentive for guys who are going back to their clubs in a week on, you know, millions of dollars of wages. So I think it's just this dramatic come down of the most important game of their lives to a completely meaningless game that no one wants to be playing in. And it's just hard for me to remove that aspect of it, the no one wants to be here element, and get up and get excited for a game where everyone feels that way.
And particularly he goes, oh, well, we're squeezing another game out of a World Cup we've loved. Yeah, but we've loved the World Cup because the group stages had games right to the final day that mattered. This doesn't matter.
Yeah, I'm not telling, look, if you love it, then continue watching it. Like, that's fine. But for me, it's not a game that I'm ever really going to get excited about.
Yeah, and I've just ruined your last name as well. And I'm so sorry, please.
Maybe you got it right. I don't know.
But you made me say it again, and so I've definitely got it wrong once. Dave Bleha. Bleha. It's a silent.
You looked much more natural that time.
It's a silent J, and even if I'm wrong,
Yogging.
You'll be forever called that. And finally, from the mailbag section, Enrique Ruiz. I'm a listener of the podcast since it appeared for the first time on the ESPN FC podcast and have not stopped listening ever since. I'm from Puerto Rico and I feel like I'm the only island boy who listens to you guys. You might not believe me, but after the Hurricane Maria hit our island, the only podcast I had saved in my cell phone was the Caught Offside Pod, which I heard to keep me sane and relaxed, regardless of the long hours I spent searching for resources and Wi-Fi to download more episodes. God. You guys were practically the only friends I had during those months. I'm currently working in NYC for the next couple of months and want recommendations of soccer bars. I remember once I went to this bar that was decorated with everything of Tottenham and I want to go there again since I'm a Spurs fan. Thanks for the great content you bring to our ears every week. Love the chemistry both of you have and the show as a whole. Cordially, Enrique. That's one of those where you're like, wow. That blew me away. Now, can I... I'm sure Enrique allowed me to have a bit of fun with this for a start. With an absolute tragedy, in the aftermath of a hurricane, looking for Wi-Fi to download our nonsensical ramblings on football doesn't seem like a priority.
I'll be honest, that email was so nice.
Yeah.
I like don't even know what I can say to like to even comment on it.
Well, you can help him with his question.
Flannery's is an official New York Spurs bar in Manhattan on 7th Ave and is it 14th Street? I believe it's 7th, 14th and 7th. It's a Tottenham bar. You and I went there for the...
That was fun.
Yeah, for the League Cup final. Yeah, Spurs lost.
It was so long ago it was called the Worthington Cup.
but yeah, so hopefully that helps you. It's a, if you show up there in any Spurs apparel, maybe they'll give you a free drink. Who knows?
Well... I think we should almost go and buy a drink in Flannery's for Enrique, and whenever he drops in, he should have it on us.
That's, like, honestly, hearing that is, like, crazy to me.
It's nuts.
And it's, wow.
And I'm glad, I mean, we've never been, no one's ever asked us at ESPN, can you do a podcast that's going to help people in a massive hurricane crisis? But I'm glad we were some kind of help.
Man, that's really, really cool. Good stuff.
Yeah, we get to our iTunes semi-final moments.
Yeah, we had so many, but...
we had to cut them to two, seriously. And also as well, iTunes takes a long time to get the actual text up. You get loads of reviews, but you don't get the reviews until a few days afterwards. So we're a little bit behind. Here we go. Favorite pod, favorite semis moment. Love this podcast. This is from someone... You know, someone who's just typed in there. They can't be bothered. Love this podcast. Favorite moment of the semis and possibly my favorite goal of all time is Giovanni Van Bronckhorst in 2010 against Uruguay. Amazes me every time I watch it. Also, this is a wild one. Unpopular opinion. I was a big fan of the Vuvuzelas. Appreciate all the work you guys do. Thanks, Brad.
Here's the Van Bronckhorst goal.
Van Bronckhorst. Well, he's gone from range and he's found an absolute beauty. Stunning goal by the Dutch captain, Gio Van Bronckhorst. Oh, there was plenty of fantasy about that.
It's one of those shots where as you're watching it develop, even rewatching it now, you think, what's he doing? Like from where he is.
Wide on the left.
Yeah.
Like, 40 yards out.
What's he doing? And then now, and the ball is in air forever, it feels like. And sure enough, goal.
Yeah. Did you know that was a kind of a nickname my friend had for me?
Vuvuzela?
Van Bronckhorst. So he thought Devani and Giovanni rhymed.
Well,
so he started calling me Giovanni, and then Van Bronckhorst signed for Glasgow Rangers. So to annoy me, because I'm a Celtic, you know, the background I come from is a Celtic background,
all right.
He starts calling me Van Bronckhorst. Huh. Review and question from Duria Proc. Love this pod. I've been listening for a year now and surely will continue to listen. Thanks for all your work. Much appreciated. Favorite semi-final memory is also my favorite match of all time. The 2006 Germany v Italy semi-final game. Fabio Grosso's curling game winner sending Italy to the final was a phenomenal cap off to that intense end-to-end match.
Alex Del Piero with a corner. Pirlo.
Classic.
Unbelievable. Thank you, Andre, for that incredible memory. What? I'll tell you, he was feeling himself. Grosso was.
In the semi and then the final.
Wow. Incredible.
Well, really throughout the tournament. Yeah.
Yeah.
An amazing run by Italy, who weren't really thought of that highly heading into that tournament.
Nope.
And then
they decided to not get out of the group in 2010.
Yeah. A team not that highly thought of at the start of a World Cup beating France in the final.
Interesting.
I don't see the symmetry at all. Well, JJ, this was very fun. I can't wait for this game tomorrow. In fact, do me a favor. I want you to get up. I want you to walk over to the window. I want you to open it. And I want you to just, from the top of your lungs,
listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.